So this is just the first paragraph of the novel. Conrad doesn't have the key. He stands at his brother Eric's apartment door, waiting for one of Eric's friends to pull it from a trouser or jacket pocket. It is 1925, and all the men are wearing suit jackets despite the July heat, despite the fact that everyone except Conrad is a composer or a musician, and Conrad had always supposed them to be a breed apart, unconcerned with propriety. The only composer he's ever known personally was his brother, and how well did Conrad even know him? Not well enough for a key.
Caitlin, tell us about this French composer, which I imagine perhaps a lot of Americans are not familiar with, but in France they are, Eric Satie. Why him? What was it about him that fascinated you enough that you wanted to write this historical novel about him?
I first became familiar with his work as a kid, as a piano student. My teacher gave me a piece of his called Gymnopédie No. 3, which whether or not you think you know it or you think you've heard it, you almost certainly have. Whether that's because you played it or you purposefully seek it out on classical radio or Spotify, or just because it happened to be in the background of a commercial or a TV show or a movie. It's very beautiful. It's very evocative. There's this sort of sense of melancholy to it. I've heard it behind like breakup scenes or somebody losing a love. And as a student, I loved it. It's also not terribly technically difficult, and I was not a particularly talented pianist, so that part was also appealing. And I just wanted to play as much of his music as I could. And the more that I sought out, he had some pieces like the Gymnopédies or the Nausiennes, very beautiful solo piano work. And then a lot of things that were just much more experimental, much more playful, often in miniature pieces, just a few lines long. And a lot of things just strange to me at the time. A piece called Dried Embryos, which has like lines of dialogue from a sea cucumber. He was also really playful with performance indications. So where another composer is just going to write, you know, to play it quickly or slowly, he would write, play it like a nightingale with a toothache.
I love that.
And just this wonderful, creative, often very funny body of work. And as a piano student, I was a little bit annoyed. I had just wanted, you know, endless Gymnopédies. But certainly that planted that seed of curiosity as to who was the person who had created this really divergent range of music. And I just held on to that curiosity for a long time until I was a writer and looking for the next idea and going back to him and his work and starting the research process.
Tell us about that research process. I understand you went to France. Was that your first time there?
It wasn't. I had spent, I haven't spent particularly substantial time in France. I haven't lived there. My French is, I can read in it, I can get by in it, but certainly not fluent. But I had spent some time there. So I went back with the idea that I was going to look up old addresses, old stomping grounds. A couple of the cafes he frequented are actually still in operation, which is wonderful. You could still go to the Auberge du Clos, which shows up a lot in the book. And just experiencing different streetscapes, different buildings, both in Paris and then this really kind of grimy industrial suburb where he lived later in his life. And then also traveled to the north of France, to Normandy, which is where his family was from and where he lived for some years as a child. And that was a landscape, I think, when you're writing about Paris or when you're writing about, you know, Belle Epoque Paris or your Paris at the turn of the last century or artists in Paris, I was always very aware that there's a lot of cliches that go along with that. There's a lot of kind of received images that we have of that time and those people. And I wanted to make those new and push back against that in the book throughout. And then the places that I hadn't necessarily seen on the page before, like Honfleur, his hometown, that was such a pleasure because those were spaces where it was a little bit easier to do that as a writer, to just do something that maybe the reader wouldn't have seen before.
And why did you choose to do a historical novel rather than, say, a novel? Is it easier? Is it harder?
It was not easier for me. I can't speak for other writers. I found it a tremendous challenge. I found it a really rewarding challenge. The other work I had done, I was a short story writer primarily, and my short stories were set in contemporary times for the most part. So that this was historical fiction, that it was fiction based on real lives. So I was having to reconcile not just daily life in the period research, but also a lot of biographical research, also a lot of works of music scholarship. I wanted to represent his music, you know, well and correctly. I hope the book is intended to be appealing both to people who maybe know his work already and to people who don't. You absolutely do not have to do like a Seti appreciation course before coming to this novel. That was never my intention. But I wanted the way that I spoke about the music to be informed and to be interesting. So there was there was a lot of layers of research, a lot of types of information to reconcile. And it was a huge challenge for me. But it was also the challenge that I wanted to take on. I spent a long time as a story writer watching other writers create maybe that failed story that was failed because it was just clearly a novel-sized idea. And I just, for years, I didn't have novel-sized ideas. I had a 5-page sized idea or 10 pages or 20 pages. And then when this came along, it was this mingled joy and terror that, you know, all right, this is definitely a novel. This is a novel you're going to have to work hard to figure out how to write, but it is a novel. And I wanted to go for that.
Well, you've obviously been successful in writing this book because you've gotten a lot of critical acclaim and a lot of notice. You even got an Oprah mention. There are writers who would kill for that.
Yeah, I've been feeling very lucky.
Did that have any kind of effect or to get you attention? Or how did that come about? How does one get Oprah to read your book?
So my publisher for this book is Little Brown, and there are people there working on the book's behalf. I have a publicist who is just makes a lot of calls, sends emails, knocks on a lot of doors, and some of it pans and some of it doesn't. And this was one where she got the book to Oprah's people, at least. I don't know if the book made it all the way to Oprah, but Oprah's people read the book and included it on a list of top books for July. It was thrilling.
Now, you also teach at Grand Valley State University, Warren Wilson College, and you're on the advisory board of Kenyon Review, which I think most readers and writers know. What are the important lessons for writers and maybe for readers?
If I thought that success as a writer was solely dependent on some kind of inborn talent, I am in the wrong profession. 'Cause I absolutely feel that people come to my classroom with all kinds of different backgrounds, with different levels of experience as writers and as readers. And certainly I feel it's my job to help them improve as much as they can and also just help them start to think about what do they want out of their own writing? What have the books that they love given them, and what are the skills they're going to need to give that experience to somebody else? I think when you have a group of writers in a room, not everyone is trying to do the same thing. Not everyone has the same aesthetic, nor should they. So taking these really disparate tastes and interests and ambitions and thinking about, you know, what is it that is going to help all of us? What are the skills we need? How can we be effective readers for each other? And really being sort of generous, observant readers, I think is so important to being a writer. And recognizing that it's going to take a lot of work. There's an essay that I love to give students that's called The Talent of the Room. And you can Google that and read it. It's by Michael Ventura. And the talent of the room is just whatever your other talents, you know, talents for character, for beautiful sentences, or for, you know, exciting plot. You need the talent to be able to sit with yourself in a room with your laptop or your notebook with a lot of self-doubt, with a lot of people who maybe would just as soon you get out of that room and go do something with them, and just have the patience to see that project through.
Caitlin, as you mentioned, in your past, you've been a story writer predominantly. Your story collection, This Is Not Your City, also got a lot of attention. New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice. Barnes & Noble noted you as a new writer. And there's quite a list there. Are you more comfortable with stories than novels? Is that a natural progression of moving from stories to longer pieces? What's coming next? What are you returning to?
So I have a book coming out probably 2021 that is another story collection.
Ah.
And that doesn't mark a turn away from the novel so much as many of the stories in the collection are stories I wrote while I was supposed to be working on the novel. And because for a long time I did feel much more comfortable as a short story writer, I would sort of squirm away from the novel. I would start working on it. I would feel overwhelmed. I would write another story and publish it in a magazine or come back to it. And then I would poke at the novel again and maybe go write an essay. And finally sort of realized that this was, as much as I loved stories and as much as I was still, you know, learning about that form and having fun with that form, if I was ever going to finish a novel, I needed to focus and turn all my writing attention towards that. And I think that experience is relatively common for a lot of fiction writers. When you sign up for fiction classes, often you're writing short stories because that's what's achievable in the space of an academic calendar or a semester. So a lot of writers chafe at that. Some really embrace that. Some people end up sort of eager to set the short story aside. Other people very fully identify as a short story writer and don't have an interest in a novel. And part of the process for me was trying to figure out, did I just feel obligated to write a novel? Did I really want to? And ultimately, as much as I loved stories, I was just eager for this next, artistic challenge to do this thing I hadn't done and figure out how to do it well.
I'm wondering if you listened to Satie's music as you wrote, or did you write in silence?
I listened to a lot of Satie while I wrote, sometimes in silence, sometimes Satie, sometimes other composers of the period. I listened to some Debussy while doing this, Ravel, Poulenc, Stravinsky. A special shout out to Darius Milhaud, who is not in the book, but for various reasons, but who was a friend of Satie's and learned from him a little bit and did just sort of wonderful, really early jazz influenced music. And I listened to a lot of that as well.
The Vexations, that itself is another composition of his, isn't it?
It is. So it's one sheet of manuscript paper. It's a handful of lines long. And there's a handwritten note saying, advising the player about, to play this piece 840 times in succession. Mm. Player is advised to prepare themselves in a certain way. And this was just found among his papers. It hadn't ever been attempted. It's not the way that it's written. It isn't even entirely clear that he's saying this is what you should do. It's this sort of like, well, if you should wish to attempt this. And I don't think Satie in his life would have frankly had the patience to attempt this. To do this piece 840 times takes, 10 to 20 hours.
And he meant consecutively when he said that?
It would appear so. Yeah.
Wow.
People generally, it's not a single pianist, like an overnight thing. You start in the evening, you have a bunch of people rotating through to take a certain number of repetitions. And it's sort of this like festive sleepover atmosphere. Cause the piece is also very eerie sounding. There's a strangeness to it that, I have not attended a live performance. I would love to at some point, but certainly I've listened to it a lot recorded. And for me, it gets sort of stranger and stranger and stranger. And I think in a live atmosphere where you're sleep deprived, it's the middle of the night, you've heard this 400 times. It's a strange experience.
So, speaking of experiences, you're coming to Michigan News Agency here very soon for a reading. What can listeners expect?
As a writer, I've been to a lot of readings, and I've thought a lot about what makes for an enjoyable one versus maybe a less so one. I'm very aware that there's a lot of things people could do with their time. And I'm aware that there's different ways to experience a book. I mean, you could read my book in your favorite chair with your favorite snack. You could read my book on your Kindle. You could listen to the audiobook. So if you are hauling yourself out to Michigan News Agency, what am I going to offer you that's an experience with my book that you couldn't have in other ways? I'm just hoping to do that with reading some different excerpts, talking a little bit about different sections of the book, about my writing process, and really excited to talk with Joe Saxtetter, whose work I really admire. And I'm just hoping that this is, a fun, interesting night.
I'm sure it will be. Well, thank you for making time to talk with us, Caitlin. We appreciate it, and we'll see you at Michigan News Agency.
Thank you so much.